My topic tonight is something about being busy, right? Is that what you're expecting to hear about? So I bet everybody here keeps a to-do list, right?
No.
Not everybody. Most of you don't. And if you do keep a to-do list, I bet you that at the end of the day, you haven't done everything on the list. Is that right? And I'll bet that if you keep a to-do list and you haven't done everything on your list, part of the reason why is because everything that you do takes longer than you thought it would. Is that right? You think this will take that long, but it never does. It always takes longer. Even though it was the same yesterday and the day before and the day before, it always takes longer. And when your friends say, "How are you?" Most of the time you say, "I'm really busy." Is that right? Do you have that experience? Well, if this is your experience, then join the club. This is the too busy era. We're living in the too busy era. Everybody's too busy. And how did we get so busy? Well, probably a lot of reasons, but one reason is that it's possible now to do more. You can do more. And so, since we can do more, we do more. And we love it. It's great to be able to do all these things. It's such a great thing to have a big long list and check off all the items on the list. You feel, you know, really powerful and in command when you can do that. You can use your telephone and your car. You can power here and there all over the place, and you can do incredible things with your BlackBerry and your email. You can multitask. You can and it's a kind of, there's a feeling of conquest, you know, in being able to get a whole bunch of things done in a short amount of time. You really feel good. It's exciting. It means that if you can do a lot of stuff, it means that you are important. It means that you're well engaged. You're not wasting time. You're creative. You're energetic. You are making an impact. Isn't that great? We feel. So I think that we love it. You know, it's really kind of great. It makes us feel accomplished. But of course, on the other hand, we don't like it. And it drives us nuts. One thing about to-do lists is that everything on the list generates five other things. Have you noticed that? The mind is going fast and you think of great things and you think, well, if I can do this, this makes me think that this is possible, and if I did that, then I could do this. I better take care of this when that happens. So the to-do list, actually, you'd think that they would get shorter, but they get longer all the time. So you're falling further and further behind. And this is nerve-wracking and stressful. And maybe after a while, you begin to feel as if you are a prisoner of the list. The list becomes oppressive. And if you're a prisoner of the list, it means that you're a prisoner of your own life, a prisoner of your own desires, and especially a prisoner of time, because there's never enough time. That's the problem. If there's more time, it would be okay, but you're really a prisoner of time. You're doing battle with time. And guess who's winning? So in Zen, we have a story about someone who's too busy. And a monk is sweeping the temple grounds, and another monk comes in, looks at him and says, "Too busy." And the first monk replies, you should know there's one who's not busy. That's the story. Now, when you think about it, we're always doing something. It is impossible to be doing nothing. Even if someone says, you know, what are you doing? You say nothing, but you're really doing something. Even if you're taking a nap, that is something. So the point is not how many things that we have done or how many things that we will do in a given amount of time. The point is how do we do what we do? And if we're rushed and frantic, then we're too busy. And if we move through our tasks with equanimity, then we're not busy. Maybe the monk that was sweeping was moving quickly and sweeping vigorously. And maybe this looked to the other monk like he was too busy. And that's why the monk said, too busy. But inside, he wasn't busy. Even though he was moving vigorously, he was in touch with the person inside of him who was not busy. So we are sort of caught on the horns of this dilemma. We think that when there are many things to do, we're busy. When there are not so many things to do, we're not busy. But I don't think it's actually like that. In fact, you don't need that many things to do to feel busy. You can feel busy without so many things to do. And there could be a whole lot going on, but you could also be feeling relaxed. So being busy and not being busy is not a function of how many things there are to do. Because at any moment, we're always just doing what we're doing. We can't be doing more or less. And even though we have this term called multitasking, actually there's no such thing as multitasking. I know this is true experientially, but I found out from a scientist who works on the brain that this is literally the case. The brain only attends to one thing at a time. And what we call multitasking is simply doing one thing after another in rapid succession. There is no multitasking. What I'm saying is that being too busy or not being busy are interpretations that we're adding on top of our activity. In other words, busyness is not a fact of life. It's a state of mind. Because no matter what is going on, we're always simply living this one moment of our lives. It doesn't make any difference how much or how little we think is going on. It's always just this one moment of our lives. And a moment is a moment. Now a moment, all moments, you know, are not created equal. And they're not the same length of time. There are long moments and there are short moments. Because time is also not a fact, it's an experience. And probably you have noticed that a half hour in the dentist's chair lasts a lot longer than a half an hour at your birthday party. And 5 minutes on hold on the telephone is way longer than 5 minutes spent watching a movie that you really like. So time is what we make it. Time is how we live it. Time is not what is measured by the clock. And, you know, the wristwatch is a fairly recent invention, maybe 100, 150 years that we've been using wristwatches. And there was a time when there was one clock in town, and then a time before that when there were none. In ancient China, the rule was that the monk who struck the bell to wake everybody up in the morning would do so whenever he could see his hand. That's how, not by the clock. Now, of course, our world, which is so efficient and productive, operates on clock time. That's true. And this is very convenient, and it's a necessity. I mean, you know, you're here at the same time that I'm here giving this talk because of clock time. Otherwise, you know, somebody would show up on Tuesday, somebody showed up on Wednesday, somebody would come at 6, somebody would come at 10. It wouldn't work out that well. It's much more efficient this way. So we appreciate clock time. But we invented this clock for ourselves. In other words, the clock is supposed to be working for us. We're not supposed to be working for the clock. So if we feel too busy, we have put the cart before the horse. We've taken a feeling, a state of mind, a point of view for an objective reality, and then we're in the grip of what we think is that reality. And it just doesn't have to be that way. So, now maybe you never looked at it like this, but you can, I mean, it's really quite obvious, logical, and true what I'm saying, don't you think? I mean, it really is the truth. Of course, it's easy to say this. You're not cured now of being too busy because I said this, right? So it's a good idea, and I think it's true. We're too busy, in other words, because we think we're too busy, not because we are too busy. We're always doing one thing after another, and that's all. And yet, the habit of being absolutely convinced and feeling it as a reality that we're too busy is really strong. And one has to admit this. It's really strong, and it's hard to shake. Because understanding something differently is just the beginning. I think it's actually important to understand things differently, because so much of what makes us unhappy and really messes us up in our lives is the way we look at things, which we take to be just like this business of time. This is the way it is. But it's not the way it is. It's the way we look at it. So it actually is not a small thing to say, the way I'm looking at it is not right. And that's why I'm having such a problem. But changing your understanding of how things are is just the beginning. It's not sufficient, because the habit of looking at things differently and of acting on that erroneous assumption is so strong that just understanding differently with your mind is not going to do the trick for you. It's significant, but it's only the beginning. To change the way we live, we have to practice what we have come to understand enough, repetitively, until it becomes natural to us, until it becomes a new habit of body, of mind, of thought, of feeling. So you have to practice discovering the one who's not busy in ourselves. And there are many ways that we can practice this. I've been lately working with a lot of busy people, and I gave them, I have some different classes that I'm doing with different people, Among them is interesting is the people who work at Google and giving classes to the Googlers. They're very nice people. And I give them homework. And the homework assignment for this week is anytime you can think of it during the day, take 3 conscious breaths. And you can practice that right now while I'm talking to you. Take 3 conscious breaths so that when you breathe in, you know you're breathing in. And when you breathe out, you know you're breathing out. And you can feel the breathing in and feel the breathing out. And you know the difference between the two. When you take 3 conscious breaths, something that simple, it subtly but unmistakably changes your mind. Whatever you have been feeling is a little less compulsive after you take 3 conscious breaths. You are a little bit less driven after those breaths than you were before. And there's a measure, it's definitely there, it's slight, but you can see it and feel it. There's a measure of detachment and equanimity that comes even after you take just 1 breath. And you can do this in the middle of very busy activity, and it will change things. When you breathe in and breathe out consciously, even 1 breath, you become more present to your surroundings, more present to your body. And you return, you take a step backwards, so to speak, into the feeling of just being alive, which you didn't notice before because you were all wrapped up in all kind of different things, all of which depended on the fact that you're alive, which you didn't notice. But now, when you take 3 conscious breaths, even if you don't think this thought, you feel the feeling of being alive, and it a little bit removes you in a positive sense from your obsession. So I offer you this homework assignment for yourself. It doesn't take any time, really. In the middle of your day, when you're too busy, take 3 conscious breaths and see what happens. And if you do this regularly and you develop a habit of doing this, such a simple thing. I mean, it literally doesn't take any time because you were going to take those 3 breaths anyway. But if you practice doing this consciously, 3 conscious breaths, and you were to develop a habit of doing this numerous times during the day, particularly when you felt too busy, I think it would make a revolutionary change in the way that you live. The challenge would be remembering to do it. And you'd have to do it once, and then you'd forget, and then you'd do it another, you'd build up a habit of doing it over time. And taking 3 conscious breaths will help you to remember the one who's not busy, who's living in your vicinity at all times. Even when you think you're too busy, the one who's not busy is there. And you can try other sorts of meditation breaks as well. A great one is walking. Any kind of walking. When you're walking somewhere, when you're getting from your car or the train to wherever you're going, all you have to do is intentionally bring awareness to your body as you're walking, rather than doing what you usually do when you're walking, which is to be absorbed in a sort of semi-conscious funk, not knowing where you are or what's going on, thinking that this is just a waste of time between, you know, one thing and another, the time that doesn't exist. Why not turn that time into a time to find the one who's not busy? Just by bringing awareness to the body as you're moving through space, and you're moving anyway, so it doesn't take any time. And it makes a big difference to be aware of the body when you're moving. If you brighten the awareness of the body as you're moving, it will refresh you. And you won't feel rushed and pressured anymore. And your experience of time will stretch out. There will be more time. This is actually true. Try it sometime. See if when you return awareness to the body and go from one place to another, that time stretches out and you have enough time. When you're in your funk and you're rushing and all this, there's less time. And everybody's walking. When you walk to the bathroom, do it. Anytime you ever walk, you can return to the one who's not busy. Sometimes you can just use a word or a phrase to help you. You can remember our two monks from ancient China, and you can say to yourself, like a mantra, repeated, not busy. It would be very effective when you are feeling overwhelmed and there's a million things to do. You just say to yourself, not busy. It would have an impact. I do this myself. And when I say to myself, not busy, immediately I recognize that what's pressuring me is not the things that I think I have to do in a short period of time. It's my thoughts and my feelings and my old habits. And when I remember that, I can back off. Of course, I do have things to do, just like you. And those things are going to get done or not. And the world is going to survive one way or the other, and so am I, one way or the other. So why am I doing this to myself? Even if I have a crucial deadline, and most of the time, you know, the crucial deadlines I have are not really so crucial. But even if I do have a crucial deadline, I will have a much better chance of meeting that deadline if I feel not busy and proceed along with my tasks with some calmness. Feeling frantic does not make me more efficient. I don't know about you, but it does not make me more efficient. It makes me less efficient. That's when I spill a bottle of ink on the floor and have to stop and clean it up, or the equivalent. When I feel frantic, I make mistakes. And somehow the whole world is less cooperative. Have you noticed this? Furniture gets in the way and things like that when you're frantic. Now, of course, I realize it's possible that you actually have too many things to do. You've created an impossible situation for yourself. That's possible. You know, there's just too much going on. Well, then you have to change. Right? You have to assess that. And if you have done too many things, lined up too many things for yourself to do, then figure out which ones not to do and change. Because there's a tremendous value in having a measure of peace of mind. And I think it's more important than that little extra thing or two that you think you want to do. So think again. If you really are doing too many things, then change. But if you can't change, because none of the things you're doing can be left off, or maybe you don't want to change because you really think, well, I value all these things. And even though it causes me trouble, I don't want to give any of them up. If that's the case with you, then it's very important for you to find the most beautiful and peaceful way to live within the situation that you're living in. And in the end, if you feel too busy, and you feel that being too busy is unpleasant and difficult, just remember this. Being too busy is not a fact. It's a choice. Remember that. Now in Zen, this story, I'm speaking about the story of the two monks in a very sort of pragmatic way. But in Zen, there's a way of working with stories that is goes a little deeper than this. And you probably have heard about koan practice in Zen, where we meditate in a particular way with these stories. I think of it as practicing with phrases, like the phrase, not busy. And the practice of phrases consists of meditating with phrases, living with them, being with them until they pervade your consciousness. They become sort of powerful touchstones. They become unfamiliar. They lose their ordinary meaning. And eventually they reveal themselves to us, which is to say, we are revealed to ourselves through the agency of these phrases. And phrases are what, you know, what we usually think of as phrases, words, groups of words. But phrases also include, and this is the part particularly that Zen adds to it, phrases also include silence in the middle of them. The larger ineffable space that we will find in the middle of and surrounding all words and concepts if we sit and breathe with words and concepts long enough, we'll hear the silence at the heart of them. And so we bring a phrase like not busy to our meditation, breathing it with every inhale and exhale. And we inquire of the phrase, you know, what does it really mean? Not busy. So actually, to truly be not busy under any circumstances is a profound understanding of our human life. So we breathe that phrase over and over, inquiring what it means, but not expecting that we'll get the answer to what it means by our ordinary conventional methods of thinking. In meditation practice, we, Zen Master Dogen says, we think not thinking, by which he means rather than running our thinking according to our logic and our desire and our sense of self, we allow thinking to arise and pass away in a freer, more intuitive way. So instead of working with the phrase to interpret it or explain it, we're allowing ourselves to feel the whole suggestibility of the phrase through the whole body and in the gut. And we let the phrase work on us rather than our manipulating the phrase. And in Zen, as it's practiced nowadays in the West, there are different traditions and methodologies for working with phrases. Some of them are very well organized, and those are the ones that you've probably read about. The Zen master rings his little bell, and you answer the koan, and he kicks you out, and you're baffled, and you're so forth. So there are those organized curricula with, and there are actually right answers to the koans. in the way that I have practiced in Soto Zen way, we don't have those methods. Our way is a little bit more fuzzy and disorganized. There's no particular format, there are no correct answers, and there's no set curriculum. And even though I got mixed up when I first started studying Zen, I thought I was studying one method, and it turned out I was actually studying the other method, and it took me about 5 years to realize that, and by then it was too late. But as it's turned out, it's actually much better for me this way. Because I've found that I have a natural tendency, I don't say it's good, I don't say it's bad, it's just the tendency that I have to resist things that are too well organized. Because it always seems to me that real life is not that well organized. It is itself fuzzy. And spiritual approaches that seem organized, I believe, are not really organized. They just seem to be. The more you get into them, the more you find that the organization of them is a sort of a construct. And they have the disadvantage of suggesting that there's progress and development, which I think is also not so honest. Not as honest as disorganized approaches that admit that progress and development is a problematic concept to begin with. Anyway, so phrases, words, and silence in the middle of the words. And, you know, silence makes words possible. Just the same way that if you didn't have the vast space inside of every atom, you couldn't have the so-called solid world that we live in. Similarly, you couldn't have language and words without the silence that exists, you know, in the middle of language. So there's a way of practicing with phrases without it using any words at all. And this is, in our particular school of Zen, this is much emphasized. The practice of phrases, wordless phrases. And this is what you might call Zen mindfulness, which is not mindfulness of something, but mindfulness of the silence or the spaciousness that's always there whenever anything is there. The emptiness of things. To be aware of that rather than the something. And so we practice like this usually in monastic life where there's work and we work silently and we pay attention to what we're doing in this way. Sometimes also being aware of the breath in the body as we're moving. And then whatever we're doing becomes the phrase. Our activity of this moment becomes the phrase. Whatever appears before us is the mystery of the phrase. And you pay very close attention to it without defining it too much. And you inquire of it to see what it will reveal. And the practice is that everything will illuminate you. Everything will open you up if you will bring yourself to it completely. So you could pay attention to what you're doing with this spirit, or you could work with a literal phrase that might come up in the middle of your life, like, what is love, really? Who am I, really? Or you could use one of the traditional Zen phrases from the koan collections. But you bring that kind of attention to what you're doing, and you put yourself in a very different stream of life. We're putting ourselves, you know, now in a stream of life that we take to be the facts of objective reality. But it's not so. We're all involved in the creation of a way of life that we've received from our culture and from our families. It's a choice that we've made, although we don't recognize that. And this is another way. Another way of thinking about working with phrases is to think of it as a practice of radical questioning. To keep our mind fresh and open all the time. Keep on looking. What is this? What's going on here? What is this life? Who is this person? What are we doing here? If we're looking for final answers to these questions, then the practice of questioning becomes desperate and difficult. If we're driven, you know, to know something, we think we should be knowing it, and we don't know it, there's a desperation in that. When we realize that life is questioning, that there's no end to questioning, that questioning is human life, then the questioning becomes a joyful process of discovery, constant discovery. And there's no problem. The problem is not that we don't have answers to our questions. The problem is we have too many answers. And they're not good answers. To constantly challenge who we are and what we're doing is joyful. In other words, the practice of questioning is to open ourselves up to the endless difficulty and the inexhaustible beauty of being a human being. And that is what's going on every moment in our living anyway. But with the practice, we make this explicit and we turn toward it in a beautiful way. So practicing with phrases in the way that I'm speaking of is a way of undoing the trap that our mind is always setting for us. The trap of, you know, all our received identities, our buttoned-down view of ourselves and of life. And instead of just sort of plodding along based on this concept of who we think we are and what we think is going on, we're all the time asking, who is this? What is going on? And the trap falls open. And we see that each and every thing in our lives, things we like as well as things we don't like, is a barrierless gateway, not the wall that we thought it was, blocking our way forward. Each and everything in our lives is an opening, possibility, if we will bring that kind of attention to it. Being busy and being not busy is a million miles away when we have that kind of attention. It makes no difference. So, the story again. Before I told only part of it, there's a little bit more, so this time I'll tell a little bit more part of it. One monk is sweeping the ground, and the other monk says, too busy. And the first monk says, you should know there's one who's not busy. And the second monk says, oh, so there's a second moon. And now the monk holds up his broom and says, which moon is this? You You know, another reason why we're so busy is more than ever is now we're so much more aware of all the things that one should be doing in life. You know, now we know that we must exercise, take care of our bodies, and we must eat the right foods, and we must take vitamins and read the magazines that tell you which vitamins to take. And we must go to the therapist and straighten out our emotional lives, and we must talk things over with our friends and go into details about our relationships together and so on and so forth. These are things that nobody knew were important, you know. 50 years ago, nobody thought of it. So now we have many more things to do. I don't know how anybody has time to have a job. There's so many things to do just to, you know, take care of one's life properly. Not to mention the rest of the planet and recycling and, you know, all these things. So it's a mystery to me how anybody has the time to have a job with all these things that we have to take care of. So no wonder our to-do lists are so long, and no wonder we're so very, very, very busy. So we figure out we'll escape this by going on retreat. We'll go to meditation. And this will be how we'll escape all these busy things. I mean, we're exhausted and running around too busy, so we're going to meditate, and this will rejuvenate us and refresh us. So we're 10 times as busy getting things done so that we can clear our calendars to go to the retreat. And it's a very peaceful retreat, but then it's over and we come home and all the stuff that we have been piling up while we were at the retreat is now plaguing us. So we have this sort of dichotomy, like I was saying before, you know. Peaceful meditation retreat. Ah, what a relief. But then, twice as busy because of that. I actually tell people a lot, you know, what are you going to so many retreats for, you know? You'd think I'd be telling them to go to retreats, but, you know, they don't believe me. They think that I'm like it's some sort of a Zen doublespeak or something. But I really mean it. Why are you going to so many retreats? Doesn't it just make you more busy? Oh, so there's two moons. The retreat moon of nice and peaceful, and the non-retreat moon of being very busy. There's two moons. The retreat moon and the non-retreat, the person in retreat and the non-person in retreat. This is the trouble with retreats. If we think that a retreat is something other than the rest of our lives, this is peaceful over here, and this is frantic over here, and that's the way it is. We have taken good medicine and turned it into poison. When Yunyan, when this monk holds up the broom, we could be like him and we could hold up our computer or our cell phone. No, there aren't two moons. The unbusy moon and the busy moon. Every moon is unbusy. Every moment is retreat. Because every moment, if we really look into its nature, we see, we'll feel, we'll see that every moment is quiet, and every moment is decisive, and every moment is a moment of destiny. This is the moment that has to be here in our lives now. It must be this way. How could it be otherwise? Why do we do all these things that we do? Because they're practical. Because we have to. Because they're important. Because we made a commitment to them. But why do what's practical? Why do what we think we have to do? Why are things important? And why did we make commitments to things in the first place? Do we really know? I don't know if we know or not. But right now, whatever we're doing, this is our life. This is our destiny. This is what we have to be doing. So there's no hierarchy of things that we're doing. Because there's no hierarchy of things in time. Time knows no hierarchy. Time is just moment, 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 moment. So whether we're arguing a case before the Supreme Court, or sitting on a toilet seat in a local Chinese restaurant, or weeping in despair over the many mistakes that we've made in the past, we are, at that time, fulfilling our destiny to be doing right now exactly what we must be doing, exactly what we were made to do. The person who is right now doing exactly what she must be doing, what her destiny is right now, that's the person who's beyond busy and unbusy. If she's busy and rushing around frantic, worried about getting everything done, she's caught. She's caught in a trap that she has made herself. She better take 3 conscious breaths and remember the one who's not busy. So it's good for me to talk about this because this is my practice. I'm working on this all the time because I'm very busy. I've got lots to do. And I catch myself all the time in my old conditioned habits. This is important. This is what I want to do. This is very unimportant. This is a pain in the butt. This is a bother. This is frustrating. This must be done today, no matter what. This has to get done today. And I know better than this, you know. I know that this is all nonsense. And when I catch myself thinking like that, I actually stop what I'm doing right there. I literally physically stop. And I remind myself, now what's going to happen if this doesn't get done today? Nothing. What if I drop the idea that this is bothersome and a pain and I really resent doing this and I just do it? It'll be totally different. Instead of being a bother, it'll become my spiritual practice. If I'm frustrated and upset with time pressure, what's going on? What's going on is I'm repeating some old story that someone handed me a long time ago. I'm going to not be alive that much longer. And when the last moment comes, am I going to be saying, damn, I wish I had gotten that thing done on October 31st? No, I'm not going to be saying that. It's not going to matter. The other day, my wife mentioned to me that the bathroom in our house was a disgusting mess. And I took a look, and by golly, she was right. And neither one of us is that much of a house cleaner. But I decided that I had nothing else to do, and I was going to clean the bathroom, which is not what I usually do. And I was impressed with how much there is to cleaning a bathroom. You know, to really get the toilet and the tub and the sink scoured and really nice, this is a job. Then you have to get out the very expensive and complicated new vacuum cleaner and run it on the floor and all around the baseboards, especially in the corner near the toilet where it all gets really gunky. Then you have to mop the floor. Bathrooms always have mirrors. It's not that easy to get a mirror really nice without streaks. There's probably a rug on the floor. You got to put it in the washing machine and wash it. Maybe you have some pictures in your bathroom. We have some in ours, and you have to wash those pictures, clean them up. And you know, it is a pleasure to do such an honest thing as to clean a bathroom. Cleaning up a bathroom is cleaning up the entire universe. This is not a metaphor. When you take care of one thing with loving heart, you are cleaning up and taking care of the whole universe. This is the secret of working with phrases. Everything includes the whole universe. And so, to clean up a bathroom is to make a wondrous offering to sentient beings. Out of love and concern for your comfort and pleasure, I have cleaned this bathroom. And I hope that you will enjoy it. And my wife was really impressed when she came home and saw this bathroom. And I have no doubt that when she sat down on that toilet, she felt like a queen on her throne. And I felt really happy. Even though, if I would have thought about it, I would have realized I don't have time to clean this bathroom. So that's what I wanted to tell you tonight. That's my talk. And I went on for a while, and we don't have too much time left over, but a little bit. I know you're all busy, so you stay here very long. But in the few minutes remaining, if there are comments, questions, complaints, if you're bitter about something I said, I'm happy to entertain whatever you would like to say. Yes, anybody? Yes, in the back there.
Could you say a little bit more about the statement you made, every moment is decisive?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to, you know, it reminds me a little bit of, maybe some of you have heard me say this, but I often tell the story of how I tried to figure out how much, when I was getting jobs, you know, I tried to figure out how much money I should ask for per hour, you know? And I thought, well, let's see now, what is an hour of my time actually worth? 1 hour that I could never get back again, that once it's gone, I'll never get it back. In a limited amount of time, which is the only thing I've got, how much is 1 hour worth? So I started it at about $2,000. And I thought, you know, is $2,000 enough to, you know, really compensate me for an hour of my time? That, you know, this unrepeatable time of my life, is $2,000 enough? And I thought, no way, you know, that's not even close. And I was up past $10,000 an hour when I realized that no one is going to pay me that much money. And that's when I made a decision that I've kept to for the rest of my life, to never work for money. Because there's no way that anybody could pay me enough money. So what I'm saying is that it is this way. You know, a moment of life. I mean, what could be more, we don't even understand where it comes from. There's no way that we could produce such a thing. We can make tremendous rocket ships that go to the moon, but we can't make one moment of life. In one moment of my life, which is unrepeatable, or your life, which is unrepeatable, how much is that worth? Well, in the same way, it's the same idea that you know, that moment is here for a reason. You know, Buddhist understanding of karma is that basically what it amounts to is the entire universe has conspired to create this moment of my life right now. I mean, I could not be anywhere else but talking to you right now. This is the only thing that I could be doing in this moment. And my entire life has brought me here. And everything else that's gone on, you know. has created this moment. This is a precious moment, and it's my destiny to be here in this moment, just as it is yours to be here in the moment that you're here. So I guess what I'm talking about is the precious and unrepeatable nature of our lives and the necessity of everything that happens in our lives. So I don't know if that's a great explanation, but it's a feeling. I'm trying to express a feeling that I have that seems so clear to me, you know. I don't know if that helps, but yeah.
I'm not as quiet. I mean, I do like quiet at this time. When you were talking about concentrating on your steps, or that part of is that like a relaxation thing, or really? And the other thing is that I injured my body this summer, and all over. Well, pretty severe injuries.
Oh, sorry.
And so you can really, I think that's a terrible way to learn how to do that. But,
yeah.
When you learn how to do that, now does that make me more spiritual?
I'm sure.
I've done it.
I'm sure. Yeah, if you don't forget about it, yeah.
Well, no.
Yeah.
Well, I might be
even
someday. Well, that's the level.
Well, who cares? Whether you're spiritual or not, I mean, the point is, for me, the point is not whether somebody I think or somebody else thinks I'm spiritual. The point is, am I living my life? That's the point. Am I living my life in a way that's engaged and beautiful? And as you're sort of implying, sometimes a big disaster comes along and facilitates our ability to really be present and significant with our lives, because it kind of catches us up short and forces us to really look at what's going on a moment-by-moment basis. And sometimes it has a good effect on us. In fact, every disaster is a potential for a good effect on our lives if we will only not try to avoid it. I get around it, but just take care of it as we should and as we must. So, but you know, for me, I don't really care if I'm spiritual or not, or if somebody. I don't value somebody if I think, oh, they're spiritual, that's good. They're not spiritual, that's bad. It's not. It's just a matter of what kind of energy and presence do you bring to your living. So, anyway, last. Thing. Yes?
Well, thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And I offered many friends to come to this, and they also were
too busy. Yeah.
Can you get a response to the topic? I have two small children.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the experience of busyness is really, they're very, it's this kind of energy.
Yeah. Yeah. How old are they?
4 and almost 7.
Oh, fabulous.
So,
yeah.
And they're girls, and, it's either one or two.
Could be worse, they could be boys. I have two boys, so. Oh, yeah.
And then it's getting them to school and preschool, and I've let go of being on time in school. That's.
Yeah.
And so it's finding relationship with that external, very real busyness around me, and is busy, feels busy.
Yeah.
So like the not busy in that for me is really.
Yeah.
Tricky.
Well, why don't you? Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Not
yeah.
Busy.
Well, why don't you focus your mind on listening to the sounds that they make? Because you're not listening, you're thinking of all the things that you have to take care of, and that's what makes you feel busy. But if you switch that and spend some time every day just forgetting about all the things that you have to take care of, and just listening to the sounds that they make. And every now and then, really looking at them and marveling. These are your children, you know. This is a marvelous thing. How did you do that? You know? I mean, this is really something. I mean, that you have the capacity to do this, and that here are these human beings that are your children, and they're doing all these funny things around the house. And I mean, this is something. To return to the marvelous nature of that, I think, will take away, to some extent, so to train your mind that way. Whenever you feel busy and frantic, return your mind to the miracle of your children and listen to them and watch, see them, look at them. Yeah. And try to train your mind that way, to back off a little bit from them. And you'll see that if you can do that, you'll be less busy. Time will stretch out. You'll realize that a lot of stuff that you think you have to do, you don't have to do. A lot of the messes that you made because you were going too fast, that you take time to clean up, you won't have to clean up anymore, giving you even more time. Really, things can change. You don't have to be frantic if you have two little children, you know. I mean, the house won't be quiet. But you know, if what I was saying is that there's a silence inside of your children's noise, and there actually is, if you can hear it. So, this is a precious thing. You're a lucky woman. So, what a shame it would be to have a miserable time of it, you know, when you're so lucky and you have such beauty in your life, you know, because it could be, it could be miserable and difficult, and it shouldn't be. So see if you can change that. That would be good. Well, it's 9. I think this is the time to end, so thank you very much.